Welcome. I think we should start. Thank you for coming. It's common to say it's a pleasure to welcome you all here. I wanted to say that it's a great honor to be sitting in this panel together with my other co-speakers, but they decided to sit in the audience for the time being. It is really a pleasure and an honor to welcome Tito Boeri and Nick Barr to this panel. Two very, very well-known economists, a very well-accomplished economist. Nick Barr is a professor of public economics here at the LSE, linked to the economics department and also, of course, the European Institute, which is organizing this series. He's written widely, both academically and in policy terms, on policy reforms, especially in relation to education and pensions, and he's advised governments, international organizations for many, many years around these themes. Professor Tito Boeri is a professor of economics at Bocconi University. He's written widely on issues related to the labor market in Europe, among other things, and he's authored one of the most, I think, influential textbooks in labor economics. He's currently president of the National Foundation for Social Security, National Institute for Social Security in Italy, and for a brief spell of time, he was also centennial professor here at the LSE, again affiliated to the European Institute. Today's topic, as you can probably see, is on labor markets, welfare, and the portability of rights, and I think we'll try to focus much on portability and making links, obviously, to the labor market, but also to welfare. We'll have the three presentations. We'll try to keep them reasonably brief to allow time for questions and answers. Unless you have a very burning question, please keep your questions for after the presentations. As you probably already know, this is one lecture in a series of lectures relating broadly to the theme of Brexit. We don't only look at Brexit in relation to Britain, inward-looking, but also asking wider questions for Britain, Europe, and more analytically, I think. So today's topic links also to previous topics. Last week we had a similar panel on the effects of Brexit on the British economy. Next week we'll continue with a topic on Brexit and the generational divide, mind the gap, on the 8th of March. And then the week after we're looking at the issue of migration. We're going to talk quite a lot, I think, today about migration, but focusing more from a perhaps more sociological perspective in 2 weeks' time. And then Brexit in the city on the 22nd of March. So please put it in your calendars and try to attend as many of these lectures as possible. The lectures are being recorded and videotaped, so you can watch the video at a later time and also hear the podcast of these lectures. Okay, I'll stop here and I'll welcome Nick Barr to kick off with our presentations on the topic today.
Well, good morning, everybody. A younger colleague, much more trained in pedagogy than I am, said that you should allow at least 3 minutes per PowerPoint slide. If I did that, we'd be here till almost 1:30. So I'm going to skip and skim. I want briefly to talk about four messages. The welfare state matters, human capital matters, mobility matters, and portability matters. Before that, a couple of background points. First of all, just some facts. A lot more international trade. I mean, this slide goes back to 1960, and what you can see is a massive increase in world trade. True of most countries. Trade in the EU between EU countries has skyrocketed. The EU is much the largest trading partner for the UK. Sort of 45% of our trade is with the EU, 18% with the USA, and the rest really small. So trade's gone up, international mobility's gone up, more migration, and a lot more international travel short of full migration. So that's the sort of setting in which Brexit takes place. More trade, more migration. This slide is me wearing my hat as an academic, it's about getting the analysis right. And I could talk at length about each of those. I won't. This slide is really a teaser for Q&A if you want to come back to any of them. There's a logical fallacy. Don't confuse comparison of steady states with a movement from one steady state to the other. If we'd never joined the EU in the 1970s, we would be in good shape today, but that's not the question. The question is, we did join, we're now leaving. That's a different question. There's an empirical fallacy that somehow we can turn back the tide of history. There's another empirical fallacy. People say, what we want is a lot of free trade deals. And they also say, we want to take back control. But you can't have both, because international, because free trade requires a huge amount of international regulatory harmony. There's a misdiagnosis that globalization is the problem. It's not. And another misdiagnosis that immigration is the problem. It's not. And I'm happy to come back to any of those later. So to my first main message, the welfare state matters. We've always known that the welfare state matters to protect the poor. What is less well known is that welfare state institutions exist to do things which private markets would do inefficiently or not at all. And as many of you know, what economists call first best economics, it's the simple economic model with well-informed consumers, rational behavior, etc., which is a good starting point for analysis, but it's the wrong model on which to base policy. What's needed is second best analysis, imperfect information addressed in the literature on the economics of information, for which the Nobel Prize was awarded in 2001, non-rational behavior addressed by the large and growing literature on behavioral economics, for which the Nobel Prize was awarded in 2002. Incomplete markets and incomplete contracts, the fact that you can't buy insurance against all the risks that you'd like to insure, for which the Nobel Prize was awarded last year, but was also mentioned in an earlier year. And finally, the fact that taxes are distortionary because if you want to relieve poverty, you have to get more taxes off richer people in order to subsidize poorer people. That's distortionary. That's addressed in the literature on optimal taxation, for which the Nobel Prize was awarded in 1996. The reason I mentioned these Nobel Prizes is to say this is not some weird, wacky, idiosyncratic European Institute view of economics. It is sort of very much best practice in the subject. How does this apply to the welfare state? Well, unemployment insurance. There's a missing market if you relied on private institutions. Medical insurance. Tragically, an exam question that I use from time to time says, quote, the problems of US medical finance are entirely explicable in terms of economic theory. Discuss. The theory predicts the problems that you would have that Obamacare is getting to grips with. Pensions, huge problems of imperfect information. People don't know enough to make rational choices about competing private pension providers. I include myself in that. So the welfare state really matters. There's a second way of thinking about the welfare state that is compatible with that, which is the welfare state as a device for optimal risk sharing. If you face people with too little risk, give people absolute security, that doesn't work. If you are told that you will get your degree whether or not, you'll get your degree without taking an exam, you might work a bit less hard. This was the incentive structure under communism. You had your job for life, no matter how hard you worked, you wouldn't get a pay increase. Too little risk is suboptimal, but too much risk is suboptimal as well. If life is too risky, people won't be prepared to start up new businesses, etc. So the welfare state is a device for risk sharing. Look at the range of uncertainties we face. Economic uncertainty. Will there be another economic crisis? Political uncertainty. environmental uncertainty, social uncertainty, population aging, technical uncertainty, nuclear safety, all those pre-existed Brexit and the new US administration, add those in, and you see there is a huge amount of uncertainty that countries face, that economies face, that individuals face, and the welfare state is the primary device for protecting individuals from the worst of those uncertainties. So that's my first message, the welfare state matters. Second message is that human capital matters. In other words, investment in skills. Two reasons for that. First of all, in most countries, fertility is declining, meaning in the future there will be fewer workers. And in most countries, people are living longer, meaning that in the future there will be more pensioners. So if you've got fewer workers and more pensioners, what are you going to do? Well, the rational strategy if you've got fewer workers is to make each individual worker more productive. And the way you do that is by giving each individual worker more physical capital and more human capital. So you need a more highly educated and highly trained workforce. A second driver is what economists call skill-biased technical change, which is driving up the demand for skills. OECD analysis suggests that the top line, the green line, the demand for high-level problem-solving skills, the sort of thing that graduate students at LSE are developing in spades, that demand's been rising, so you're in good shape. Low problem-solving skills, unskilled work, has remained fairly static. The demand for medium to low problem-solving skills has fallen. So what you've got is increasing demand for high-level skills, increasing demand for low-level skills, and it's hollowed out in the middle. So those two drivers point in the same direction. You want more education and training, so more people with higher skills. You want more frequent education and training because skills go out of date more quickly than in the past. And you want greater diversity in education and training. I looked it up. When I did my MSc here a million years ago, the school put on 19 master's degrees. There's now over 100. So you need more frequent and more diverse. So that's the second message, human capital matters. Third message, mobility matters. Occupational mobility, flexibility, ability to move across jobs and skills, also geographical mobility. So for occupational mobility, the sort of increased investment in human capital I've been talking about contributes to that. You need geographical mobility in addition, within a country and across countries, partly as an element in human rights, but also to have efficient use of labour in a modern economy. So you want labour mobility, which promotes competitiveness, because what's happened is the number and diversity of jobs has exploded, the number and diversity of skills and interests of workers has exploded. So you've got a much more complicated matching problem between workers and jobs, and labour mobility is part of assisting that match. A second reason for labour mobility is it helps to bring at least some convergence in real income between richer and poorer countries with benefit to both groups. Alongside labour mobility, student mobility is also an important part of the issue. Students who have studied abroad are more likely to become mobile in the labour market. And there's also a benefit to higher education systems from having students from different countries, which increases competition between universities in a way that is beneficial.
Nick.
Yep. Fourth message, portability matters. If you get your benefit design wrong, it impedes labour mobility. This is particularly true of pensions. National systems differ, pension systems differ in terms of whether they've got contributions, as in the UK or the USA, or not, as in the Netherlands and New Zealand. They differ in the number of years of contributions you need to get a full pension. The pensions formula is different. The vesting period, the number of years you need to contribute in order to get any pension at all, varies. And the role of private pensions varies. So the problem arises if somebody moves too much. They might have worked in five countries and not got a pension entitlement in any of them. The opposite problem is that somebody, by moving to another country, would lose so much pension that they don't move. And certainly, I believe it is a case that LSE at times has failed to recruit German professors precisely because the German academic pension system, at least in the past, made it very much a loss-making activity to move outside Germany. So you've got a problem. What's the solution? Well, there's a useful distinction between portability and preservation. Portability means when you leave the UK to have the second half of your career in France, you take your UK pension pot with you. So your UK pension accumulation, you move to a financial institution in France. That's portability. Preservation is where your UK pension rights are preserved for you. They stay in the UK, but when you then retire, having had the second half of your career in France, you get half a French pension and half a UK pension. Now, pension portability and preservation is still very much a work in progress. There's been some progress on national schemes, less progress on private schemes which are more diverse. Remaining problems include things like how do you ensure that a worker's dormant pension rights, when they've left a pension plan, are treated in line with the right of people with workers who are still in the pension plan. There's differences in earliest pension age. So if you move to a country with a later pension age, can you collect a pension from your earlier country at a lower age? And you've got differences in life expectancies in different countries, which is relevant to the size of pension, annual pension you'll get from your pension pot. So portability matters. Right, briefly concluding thoughts. Britain's economic prospects, trade will fall, this will be a problem. Factors exerting adverse pressures, well, there's lower trade, there's exchange rate depreciation, which reduces living standards. What do we do about it? Strategic policy response. The key thing, I think, and this is very much a welfare state part of the puzzle, is policies that assist resilience. So strengthen the capacity of the welfare state to share risk. That has economic advantages. Risk sharing is welfare enhancing. It also has political advantages. You need more, better, and more widespread human capital to help occupational and geographical mobility. And you need to pursue multilateral and bilateral agreements with particular emphasis on good rules for preservation. Preservation is often easier to manage than portability. Political economy of reform, my last slide. A good part of the Brexit vote was people feeling they've been left out economically by a combination of long-term structural change, globalization, etc., on which austerity was superimposed. And that's what opened up, politically opened up the space for populism. So if you've got a problem, the best way to deal with it is to address the underlying problem. So the most important way to address populist pressures is to tackle the underlying problem. The underlying problem is insufficient skills, insufficient investment. So we come back to the point about a resilient welfare state and investment in human capital. And investment in human capital, don't get me started on this, not in posh people who do posh degrees at LSE. We are relatively well looked after for all that vice chancellors moan about it. It's tertiary education, sub-degree tertiary education, that needs a lot more emphasis on it. So I'd say it's part of getting the skills mix right, So the welfare state matters, human capital matters, portability matters. Vasilis will talk more about migration. Tito will talk more about portability. Let me leave it there. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Nick. This is difficult to follow, not only because of the content, but also because you managed to stay with the time allocated. So I'll try to also present many slides in too few minutes. So indeed, I'm talking about migration mobility, and also I'm going to talk about portability of skills and then of qualifications. And three key points, if you want. One is to make the point that migration and mobility are not the same thing. They're not the same thing conceptually. They're not the same thing practically. They're not the same thing in terms of what they address and what problems they cause. Then say a couple of things about the costs and gains from migration or from mobility, introducing some things that we don't often talk about outside the area of at least economic geography, and then conclude with something about the portability of skills, which in practical terms means the portability of qualifications, the recognition of qualifications across places, and how this links to Britain post-Brexit. So I'm starting with that point about migration and mobility. And of course, you can think also in the literature, we talk about migration as something which is influenced by the whole spectrum of individual circumstances. So why people choose to migrate is a lifetime, life choice decision. But often in economic, especially analysis, we focus very much on the labor market context of this decision. So in the literature, and I'm borrowing from a publication by the World Bank, you can find a number of reasons which are categorized in different ways, you know, poverty and employment, fertility rates, personal or professional development, political freedom, family reunification, all sorts of reasons. Now, of course, economists and economic analysis cannot handle the multiplicity and multidimensionality of all this, so we try to think about a utility-maximizing decision in much more narrow terms. So what you usually come across in one form or another in the analysis of migration would be something that says that your utility on the left-hand side is somehow related through a function to the expected wage or the actual wage you will get in the destination country, WD, your employment probability, if you want, in the destination country, so how likely it is to get a wage times how much this wage is worth, minus the wage you would get in your home country if you didn't move, times the probability of getting a job in your home country. So your employment outcomes and wage outcomes in the two places matter. You balance the costs and benefits, minus Z, which is the cost of relocation, emotional, financial or other, and then you have a utility maximizing decision that tells you you should go to country X, and that's where you're going to be happy. And I want to make the point that the top part of the slide, which talks about the wider context, is really about sort of the freedom to move, the freedom to escape your political uncertainties and oppression or whatever, the freedom to reunify with your family, to choose a professional career path that is not offered in your country, and things like that. It is also about sort of having a common demos in the sense that you have to have some sort of sense of political entity and belonging in order to allow people to come and pursue their professional aspirations or their family reunification near your home. Okay, so when somebody moves from, let's say, Newcastle to Sunderland, maybe unsuccessful example, people do not feel very bad about that, but when somebody moves perhaps from Somalia to Sunderland, they may have more strong feelings about that thing. Okay, so it requires this kind of thing. In the case of the second part of the slide, really what we're talking about is integrated labor markets. Yeah? You can compare unemployment rates in one place and another, wage rates in one place and another, and then you would respond to these different incentives, as Nick was referring to. And through that mechanism, we have an equalization of outcomes in the two markets, adjustment. Okay, so these are very different things, also conceptually, not only in different ways. Another picture I'm borrowing from another source looks at the reasons for factors influencing the decision to move between people from old member states and new member states in the European Union. And you can see there are some differences. So family-related relocation is much more prevalent in the West than in the East. In the East, it is much more for job-related reasons. But I want to show you a picture drawing from the example of the UK, which shows a slightly more nuanced picture about that. Now, the question, the underlying question is the mobility, the migration we experience in the UK cyclical? Is it of the type of the labour market, the bottom part of my previous slide, or the top part of my previous slide? So here you can see the blue bar showing the levels of migration into the UK. And if you look at the green line, you can see that there is some sort of negative correlation with unemployment. So you could say there is some cyclicality, actually not too much. And if you look at GDP, it doesn't show that much. If you look, however, more closely, so I'm now looking at the more recent period after 2004, short-term migration, so people who come only for a year or less into the country, and EU, non-UK nationals, you can see that there is a cyclicality, and actually if you remember how unemployment evolved in the UK, you will see there's a negative relation, especially not only when we look at all reasons of migration, but when we focus specifically on short-term migrants who came to the UK for employment reasons, you can see a more accentuated cyclical trend for immigration. And in a small picture, you can see the unemployment rate. Believe me, there's a negative correlation, 0.65, the correlation coefficient, and also a positive correlation with emigration of those immigrants. So there is cyclical mobility into the UK. It's not all permanent migration where people come to shop on the generous welfare state of the UK. Another picture is for the long-term migrants. And this is the purple line, is the evolution of long-term migration into the UK from EU, non-UK EU nationals. And you can see there's a kind of secular increase, at least since 2012. And you can say this is, terrible. The island cannot accommodate too many people, what is going on. If you look more closely, this increase is fully accounted by people in the West, in Western European countries, and especially Greece, Spain, and other places. So although it doesn't look cyclical in relation to the UK unemployment, it's very much cyclical in relation to Spanish unemployment and Greek unemployment. So the sending determinants of that. So this is mobility, because these people may then go back once unemployment in Spain and in Greece declines. Actually, in the same period, the new member states nationals who came in the UK, you can see it's more or less a flat line. So they're not coming for because of changes in EU unemployment, in UK unemployment. This looks more like labour migration in the sense that you leave a country of fewer opportunities, lower incomes, and into a country of bigger opportunities, perhaps, before Brexit. So I think there are differences that one has to take into account. How we deal with mobility, how we deal with migration is not the same. The next point that I'm moving on to is the issue of, is it painful to receive migrants? Is it costly? What are the gains? And of course, it's a huge discussion. You can build tables like this that run across many, many pages, so I'm not going to tell you anything about that. The good eyes in the audience will identify things like brain drain and brain gain and things like that, but there's much more to it. What I want to focus is what do economists say about this. Unfortunately, when we study mobility, we actually study migration, and this is a graph that presents the analysis of migration. So what you say is that I have a labor supply shock, so my labor supply, this kind of upward sloping line L1, moves to the right. As more migrants come into the economy, I have more people supplying the labor in the services in the labor market. So what does this do? It reduces wages as we move from L1 to L2. And it reduces the employment of locals. Before migration, locals were at point A, that much employment, L2, and after migration, they moved to point D with less employment. If wages don't adjust fully, and we know in practice wages never adjust fully or instantaneously, then this will create some unemployment. In the graph, this is the distance between C and B. This unemployment can be entirely upon the new immigrants, but if new immigrants are more willing to accept worker employment standards, conditions and so forth, they will displace locals. So this creates less employment for the locals, unemployment for the locals, and lower wages for the locals. So how do economists say, but migration is good on the whole? It is because we believe that this inflow of labor will create more demand in the economy. So the other line, LD, expands, which then increases wages fully or partially compensating for the wage decline and increases employment on the whole. And then, it's, as economists would say, it's a matter of distribution, how the costs and benefits are equalized within society. What I want to take you at is that when I want to analyze mobility, I have to start from a different premise. It is not the supply shock. It's not the people moving from, let's say, Poland to the UK that matters. It is that the economy expands, and if it expands, so this movement from LD1 to LD2, it pushes up wages, and maybe if there's no full adjustment in the economy, I will have a partial adjustment. What I will have is excess labor demand that I cannot satisfy. So I'm in this area where B, the distance between B and D, cannot be satisfied. And what I need to do is to bring new employment, new skills, new people into the economy. So it is the availability of that, it is, if you want, the shortages of nurses in the UK that invites nurses from other countries to come and work in the NHS. It's not that because nurses came into the UK, they self-selected to come into the UK, all of a sudden more nursing needs appeared in the UK. Now, if this happens, and I don't want to tire you too much with the mechanics of the graph, basically, over the cycle, as demand moves from LD1 to LD2 and back to LD1 when the economy contracts, we have a cyclical move of wages and employment in the domestic economy. And if you allow this to happen, to be facilitated through expansions in labor supply, through mobility from outside, then what you actually produce is you facilitate the cyclicality of the economy with fewer costs, fewer uncertainty for the locals. The change, the expansion and the contraction happens with the mobile labor, so what you have is employment stability, more in relative terms, employment stability for the locals than otherwise. So it is, in a way, a stabilizing force, and I think this is something that needs to be emphasized, that mobility is good. Is it always that migrants, immigrants benefit? I have two pictures, again, from the UK experience. This is comparing unlike with unlike, so Poles and English people working in England in different occupations, and the red line shows the average wage of the English people. You can see that in all but one occupations, if you're English, it gives you a higher hourly wage than if you're a Pole. Of course, you can say, well, maybe Poles are not as well educated as the English, or they do not possess similar skills. So the next graph then shows how much more educated Poles people from Poland are, Polish nationals, compared to English nationals working in England in every occupation. And you can see that in any single occupation, the Poles are overeducated relative to the English counterparts, so overeducated and underpaid. It's not the full story, but it is a picture that says something. And if you go to very detailed occupations, there's only very few occupations on the very left where the Poles are disadvantaged in terms of education. So this is a very universal picture. So where I want to go before really finishing is to tell you about other benefits, which are not to the individual, they're not to the locals or to the immigrants, but actually broader benefits from that type of mobility. Not permanent migration, but mobility which responds to differences in the economic cycle. One thing is matching. Matching in the sense that when my economy expands, I need more skills and I cannot find many of them. I cannot find enough skills to satisfy my labor demand. Skill shortages, think of the nurses at the NHS or doctors. And then migration mobility is absolutely necessary for that. It is absolutely necessary to address skill shortages, also because it takes time. If I identify that I need more doctors, it will take me at least 7 years to produce new doctors domestically, so I need to bring some from abroad. There's another important thing that is very common in economic geography, which is about the skills acquisition. It is much more easy and common and productive, cost-effective, to acquire skills when you hang out with other people who have good skills and they apply them at the same time as you try to apply them. In other words, it's much easier to excel, let's say, in economics or in political theory or whatever, when you study in LSE than if you study at your somewhere hidden in your bedroom at a remote island somewhere in Greece. This interaction adds a lot to your learning. And it applies to sort of formal studies at LSE in the same way that it applies to practical skills in the construction sector and everywhere. So this skills acquisition doesn't happen if everybody stays put in their place and they suffer when there's high unemployment, they're happy when there's low unemployment. You need this churning, this mobility. And then additionally, because then there's the idea of redeployment of the skills. Not only you acquire new skills, but then the next time the economy reshuffles, you find another place where you can go back and apply your skills, redeploy your skills, perhaps also back home. So you bring in more entrepreneurship, the brain gain from return migration, and then resolving skill shortages also in your home country, which was previously depressed, transferring technology. So I'm closing with the very last slide, which then takes that in relation to the portability of skills, essentially the portability of qualifications. I want to say something that I often say to my students about how clever the European Commission is. They come up with some statements which present, you know, they set the agenda. So one of these statements in a recent document about the European EQF, qualifications framework, the revision of it, says that lack of transparency, understanding and valuing of skills and qualifications is a hindrance to geographical and occupational mobility of workers and learners, so lifelong learning, that affects the EU as a whole. If it affects the EU as a whole, it's a problem of the European, you know, for the European Commission to address. It's a major cause of the underuse of available skills, and as such, it's an important cause of skill mismatches. So it presents as an economic problem for which the EU has a competence. And the question is what happens to Britain once they leave this very nice framework. The UK has participated in all processes around, of and around the European Union. The Bologna process, which is not entirely of the EU, for higher education, and then the process of the Copenhagen process, and more recently renamed as Turing process, on vocational education and training, mutual recognition of some sort of vocational qualification across the EU. But also participate in the common framework. I think they fully adopted the European Qualification Framework, EQF, by 2010, and all other things like Europass, credit systems, and so forth. And they participate in common agendas, wider agendas within the Europe 2020, like the skills agenda, and so forth. So I'm closing with this very open question. What happens to the UK post-Brexit? Will they shadow the processes that are developed in and by the European Union outside without the participation of the UK, or will we have a divergence of frameworks? Now that they have adopted fully the EQF, will they now revert back and stop following future developments within the EQF? That's an open question also for policymakers in the UK. They started also kind of borrowing from the German model about apprenticeships. Now that you're leaving the EU, are you also leaving the learning diffusion of the European continent? And I think these are important policy questions, not only because of questions of efficiency, but also of questions of legitimacy. If you leave the EU and you still apply the EQF, somebody, a skeptic, may say, well, you haven't actually left the EU, so what happens here? Okay, I'll stop here. Thank you for your attention.
Let me say first that it is very nice and refreshing to be back here. As Nick and Vasilis did most of the job, I think I can focus more on the political economic dimension. And I would like to talk about something which is a bit broader than Brexit, because I believe that what is currently at stake is more than Brexit. It is, to some extent, the future of the euro, and also the future of the European Union, at least as we know it. There are four elections to come, the Dutch, French, German, and Italian election in the next year or so, and clearly the outcomes of this election will shape the future of Europe to a large extent. About this, there are three messages that I would like to deliver. The first one is that, indeed, migration, as was already pointed out, is a key issue in determining the outcomes of this election. And there is a need to decouple migration and the welfare state. Otherwise, what we have been building up as tools of social inclusion may turn out to be weapons of mass exclusion, as they seem to be playing this role in a number of elections recently. The second thing is that the best response to the refugee migration crisis, because we have to talk about refugee is a different concept than economic migration and poses different challenges than economic migration, is by allow also the refugees to be matching in a better way with economic conditions of the recipient countries. This is what is not right now in the rules for refugees migration. And in this respect, there are clearly advantages in having a larger labor market, including a European labor market well functioning. And the last message is that we really have to enforce portability, because portability so far has not been existing in Europe, and portability, if properly enforced, may also become a way to reassure citizens about the fiscal sustainability of migration and the fiscal sustainability of the refugees waves that we are experiencing. And I will make a proposal, which in my view is feasible in this respect. But let me start by simply showing and documenting that when we talk about populism, we do talk a lot about the issue of migration. There are various definitions of populism. Basically, this is a thin theory which is anti-establishment. Most of the workable definition of populism are based on xenophobic and right-wing movements opposing migration. This is simply a correlation being done recently over time, and there is a time series and a cross-country dimension here, showing very clearly that the share of votes for extreme right-wing parties is increasing in the share of immigrants in different countries. There is also an indirect, I call it multiplier effect, related to the role of populist movement. They do condition also the platforms of the other parties. So we see that when the share of votes of a populist party increase, also the other party, the non-populist ones, do tend to reduce the distance with respect to the platforms of the populist parties. So this is a measure of the distance in the platform. So we have seen a lot of that in also recent elections. So taking some anti-migration positions also for parties which were not populist. Now, this finding that populism is increasing in migration is also confirmed by multivariate analysis that control for the characteristics of the respondents and also for the local conditions. These are two studies I'm just presenting this here for as an example. One is looking at the case of Flanders, and basically looks at controls for unemployment conditions and also some measure of social capital. Well, basically it says that the population from the Maghreb and Turkey really was very important in determining the votes for Vlaams Bloc. And this is another study on Australia. This is more using an ideological dimension. So basically it shows that, these movements do offer negative messages, offer what I would call a short-term protection against the challenges imposed by migration. It's very short-term in that it doesn't take into account the long-term consequences, but it appears to be rather credible, and clearly right-wing also seem to be more credible in containing migration. So far I didn't talk about the welfare state, but there is clearly, let me get now to the welfare state. I've been doing myself some work on the determinants of negative perception vis-a-vis migrants, and what I've seen by looking, this is based on the European Social Survey, which is a very powerful instrument to look at perceptions about migration in Europe, is that the key determinant of the negative perception is not really the labor market, is not the crime rate. I don't know, for some reason it was underlined the crime rate coefficient, but the largest coefficient here is the one related to the fiscal drain. So, people are very much concerned about the consequences of migration on the financing of a welfare state, and this is particularly so after this very long crisis that left many people rather unprotected. So in addition to fearing the inflows of migrants for various reasons, they also are concerned about that, because I think that the type of protection that was offered to them during this very long crisis and deep crisis in many countries, this institution may not survive such a large wave. Moreover, the refugee crisis is more serious than a simple migration inflows or massive migration. We don't see very much economic migration, indeed, as also Vasily was documenting. When unemployment goes up, economic migration doesn't increase. So there is this way of cushioning also the potential cost and the problem related to migration associated to the fact that people do decide when and where to move. But in the case of a refugee migration, the determinants are different. The first key difference between refugee migration and economic migration is that the push factor that were listed before are really the most important ones. It's not the pull factor, but push. And there is very limited choice by the part of the refugees about where to go. So they wouldn't be able to choose to go to the strongest economies where they can find a better, clearly economic conditions. Secondly, it tends to come in larger waves than economic migration. You know, the Syria crisis has brought about some 22 million people. Of these, there are at least 6 million that have left the country and are refugees. So these are very large numbers. Third, regulations are substantially different for refugees than for economic migrants. The application should be made in the country where they get, so it's not really something you could process before. The applicant cannot work and draw welfare without at the end of the day draws welfare without paying for it. So there is no way to work for quite a long time. And the integration of refugees is way longer, takes way longer than the integration of economic integration of the other migrants. Refugees are 50% less likely to work than economic migrants in the first few years since arrival. This is from some research from CREAM. The convergence between refugees and economic migrants takes place in about 15 years, so it's a long time. And, you know, what we have seen in Europe recently and, you know, was behind the rise of populism everywhere in Europe was this fact. So the huge increase in refugee migration. This is really, I think, the key challenge we are currently facing. So refugees all over, I think, are more likely to be perceived as a burden than economic migrants. And indeed, if you look at the propaganda, you know, in various countries, you know, the statements are really outrageous here, but this is what is being said in several elections. Ways out. I think that one should really decouple migration and the welfare state, so make sure that these inflows of migrants are not perceived as a threat to the welfare system. And in order to do that, the key thing to be done is to try, and as much as possible, clearly, to increase the insurance component of the social protection, of the social protection system. So basically, only contributors would be allowed to get some of the transfer, clearly not all, because there are also some transfers that clearly are basically assistance, related to assistance. But there should be some way to share these assistance schemes across countries. The second thing is that we should emphasize, as you know, populists are short-term. There is a short-term advantage in having more migrants and more refugees, which is related to the funding of the pension systems. We know that this is not a long-term effect, because in the long term, also the immigrants will get and draw pensions. But in the short run, given that they're younger, they do pay more than they would get out of the system. In Italy, to give an example, they currently pay in every year some 8 billion euros of contribution, social security contribution, and they take out only 3. So there is a surplus of 5. We know over time this unless they leave a country and don't draw a pension. Some of them do that, actually, but they will also draw pension, and this advantage will fade away. But basically, this is a short-term advantage and can be used. We also need to speed up the integration of the refugees into the labor markets, because there is no way, we can avoid the problem of the refugees. The first way is to allow this to come in relatively large markets, because there is a matching problem, as I was stating before, and having a large market is very important. The secondly is to have relatively mobility-friendly institutions for the contributors to the system. So that also is important for the reasons that were mentioning before. A mobility-friendly institution allow for better matching. And thirdly, there should be some way to induce these people to believe, to think, to invest in their integration, which is not being done currently, as they also perceive their stay as a very temporary one, and that clearly makes things more difficult from the standpoint of integration. All of this goes in the direction of trying and making the refugees as much as possible similar to economic migrants, because they should be allowed as well as the migrants to match, to go really where their skills, their qualifications are most needed. And this is not something which is happening right now. Refugees are more in the spirit of a forced marriage due to exogenous circumstances than of the good match that is the key determinant of the decision, the economic decision to migrate, you know, the type of decision that was modeled before by Vassilis. Now, let me just show some evidence that documents how larger markets are better for matching and also allowing the refugees to integrate. This is an analysis of the votes for xenophobic parties in Italy, and here we look at all municipalities, and then we look only at the relatively large towns. We see very clearly that the small towns are those where clearly the xenophobic votes do increase and are strongly associated to the share of migrants. In large conurbation, in large towns, this doesn't seem to be happening. You know, there are clear advantages in being a relatively large labor market. They are better to absorb these large shocks, this large migration wave. There are less also of a type of cultural amenity effects, diversity effects that are associated to migration in large towns. People, you know, there is a large community there. There is also a quicker job finding of those coming, because there are network, including their connationals, and other scale effects. There is more room for self-selection, even when they are forced to stay in a given town, because they can self-select into different jobs within the town, and the labor market of the town is relatively large. There is also better matching in the market for personal services. We should not forget that in Europe, in some countries in particular, those having a relatively weak welfare state, the migrants have been very important in offering long-term care to elderly people, and in large conurbation this is easier to match them with this need. So by all of these reasons, they do seem to increase the cost of gambling for its erection, which is basically one of the key motivation for voting for the populist movements, or by people who also understand that they have a very short-term horizon. Now, let me go then to the portability issue, because I think this is a part of a story, and it's very can be a quite important part of the story. So in addition to allowing migrants to go to large towns, it's important to allow them to go as much as possible to an integrated European labor market. So the barriers that are being built in Europe are very, very disturbing in the way we can handle also the refugee crisis. A European labor market would be the best response. It is also for those displaced by the crisis and trade and technology and also migration shocks, especially young people, and this is very clear also to the young British people who voted for the Remain. But it is true also for the immigrants, because they are particularly mobile, and this is a serious problem. Let me go at the end about this issue of the portability. Portability is very important to allow for mobility. I agree with the distinction made by Nick about preservation and portability. I think that if there is a cost associated to moving from one country to another, because you lose parts, so there is an issue of preservation to some extent, of your social security right, or you are put in a less favorable, and here is more portability, favorable position than people not moving at all from one country to another, that will clearly reduce and discourage the type of mobility which is needed to allow for this better match. Now, in Europe, in the European Union, since the Rome Treaty, it was stated that there should be full mobility of workers. As long as they pay, they can make their own living, they should be allowed to move across borders freely. But as a matter of fact, we never enforce the portability of rights, which is a key ingredient of this principle. So we should do something about that. And doing something about that would also be a way to take care of some of the concerns of our citizens about the welfare state. Because what happens right now is that if an Italian worker, a contributor, leaves Italy and goes to the UK or goes to France or to Germany, we completely lose track of this individual. So this individual may actually go somewhere else and apply for some welfare payments or other scheme in Italy or elsewhere, and then work in another country. So this is, we completely lose track of this type of effect. So we have been proposing to other, and this is in my current position of President of Italian Social Security, to other institutions in Europe, the German, the French, the Spanish, and the Poles, so far are very keen to doing this, to introduce in Italy, in Europe, a unique social security identifier. Is a code. It's not changing policies, clearly. We can't change policy. There is no harmonization of social security systems across Europe. Simply is a way to monitor people, and it could be the basis also to allow for full portability, which means basically that each country is responsible pro rata, on a flow basis, for the rights that have been acquired in that specific country based on the national regulations, clearly. So would also be a way to allow for this type of competition, realistic competition across systems, but would also be a way not to to discourage people from moving from one country to another. And there may be also another dimension by which this this choice could be useful, and this is to create this common demos, this identity in Europe, because we know that in the history of the US, the social security number has been quite powerful in building up a national identity. So doing something similar in Europe may be quite helpful in this respect, also because social security is to some extent also really the key principle that make our continent different than others. Thank you.
Thank you, Tito. We have just less than a half hour for our Q&A session. There's a mic somewhere.
Yeah.
So when asking your question, more than one maybe, yes, can I please ask you to stand up to ask your question? That's for the benefit of the videotaping. And also, if possible, state very briefly who you are or your affiliation, and then ask your question succinctly. Okay, we'll start with Steve.
Hello, Steve Coulter, European Institute. So Nick's point about the importance of labour mobility in enhancing domestic human capital. What about the Eurosceptics' argument that actually the UK simply free rides on the skills regimes of other European countries. And if we detach ourselves from that, that will force us then to up our game on our own skills regime, and we'll have the skills we need and a more contented and happy and higher skilled population.
I mean, I think I would just go straight back to Adam Smith, gains from trade. You know, countries produce what they are relatively better at producing and then swap. And if one combines that with the scale effects that the importance of which is reinforced by the complexity of matching today, it seems to me that larger is better. And if it is the case that we are free riding on skills produced in other countries, several responses. One is the EU rightly redistributes from richer to poorer countries, and that's part of the story. Another bit, wearing my higher education finance hat, is if you have student loans, then students, graduates up to a point, contribute to the costs of their own higher education, which reduces the loss to Poland or the Czech Republic if some of their citizens come here. So I would say, yes, what you say is relevant, but it's not overriding.
If I may, can I add something on that? I mean, that's an interesting question, an interesting issue. But I think that there's nothing to guarantee that with Brexit, Britain will go to the good equilibrium where they decide to invest. And I think this is so much a political choice, a policy choice kind of issue rather than an automatic response, market-based response. So you can easily write a model in economics where Britain will regress to a low equilibrium where, because of the unavailability of skills, it will specialize on sectors where it has an advantage, which is not the sectors where it draws migrants from. So you can think about, okay, police plumbers, but you can also think about people from actually across the world in the financial sector. So it is not that it will necessarily train more financial experts or even doctors after Brexit. It could be that it will lose the sectors. I think, in fact, if you were thinking only in terms of economics, the second outcome would be more likely, so it would only be a political decision or a policy decision that we want to train more doctors or more financial experts. And if that is the case, then you can take this decision also inside the EU. There's nothing that the EU tells you, no, don't do that. Okay. Tito, you want to say something? Okay, another question. Kevin.
Thanks. Kevin Featherstone from the European Institute. I was intrigued by Tito's outline of the responses to migration. In the Brexit debate, one of the proposals that has been floating around is whether the UK could establish visas for workers to come only to London, for example, because our labour market impact is tremendously different between the South East and the North. I'd like to comment on that as a economic policy, feasibility, etc.
That's a very interesting question. Clearly, London is a key case of the advantages of having a relatively large labour market for matching. There is quite a lot of evidence that in the matching of skills, there are very important scale effects. So the larger is the labour market, the easier is to find a match, and also, you know, the cost of matching is, are lower. So to some extent, the idea of having a visa conditioned on people only going and working and living in some areas seem to be working in that direction. At the same time, I believe that this type of things would happen without necessarily having a regulation. It's clearly, if you're talking about economic migrants, if you're talking about refugees, as I said, it's a different issue. But if you're talking about economic migrants, it is in their interest to choose the location where they can make better use of their skills and find a job at a faster pace and be more productive, earning more. And the problem with large conurbation is that they also have a relatively high living cost and high rents. So this may discourage some people to come and may create a lot of commuters, and that's the condition where there are these famous say we wish to have workers, and at the end of the day we got people also we got in a, so to some extent this is you put London in an ideal situation because they get people working relatively low wages and being productive and so on, but there are other towns where these people live and where there may be some problem of social, cultural integration, and so on and so forth. So that's not an easy problem to be solved. I think that if London wants to attract more migrants, and so perhaps a better policy would be really to invest more in residential housing for migrants in London, something about that.
I mean, I think there's... I mean, Tita set out the economic arguments, which I completely accept. If there is a political problem about immigration, then maybe having London only visas, even if it's economically suboptimal, if it makes the thing politically feasible, is worth bearing in mind for that reason as well.
Hello, Thalia Mayoglu, Hellenic Observatory. You have mentioned the fact that it would be possible to have a sort of portability of rights. There are a lot of people, especially younger generations, who don't have sort of permanent contracts. So if you accumulate short-term contracts in different countries and you don't have a lot of rights to pensions, that could be a kind of problem. And also, talking about mobility, maybe mobility is easier for people who can feel also comfortable in their new setting, unless they are those that are the immigrants who are afraid for their lives, so they're just moving. But those who are like the economic immigrants might be people who are maybe better qualified, as Vasilis Monasteriotis mentioned. You have communities, and I have experience, for example, I was at Cambridge and I took the taxi and the driver told me he was Irish and he felt so alienated because people were not inviting him to the pub. And at the same time, a French village close to the frontier with Switzerland, if you were French but you didn't have three generations in the cemetery, you were excluded by your classmates in the little village. You go to Crete or to another place in Greece, and if you are a public servant who moves there from another part of Greece, not just an immigrant, you are excluded from the social life of the X little village. So, yes. Thank you.
Who would like to? I mean, with portability of rights, I mean, there's two sets of benefits. There is benefits you get this year in relation to contributions you've paid this year or last year, unemployment benefit or access to healthcare. And there's benefits you get on the basis of a lifetime of accumulation, like pensions. And I think the short-term ones are obviously, I mean, they're difficult, but they're less difficult because you can have a contribution requirement. If you want to have people, mobile workers, building up a pension entitlement, then ideally something like an EU social security number would be very helpful. Having an individual pension accumulation lends itself both to portability and to preservation. The big problem with individual accumulations is that if they're badly designed, administrative costs erode a huge amount of the return. So what's needed are safe, cheaply administered savings vehicles. And there is a case for having an EU-wide one. You know, that there is, if you like, a one-stop shop for an EU-wide simple savings instrument that can be left accumulating in Italy if that's what you want to do, or bring it over to London within the same pensions wrapper if that's what you want to do. This is all technically very, very easy. It's merely a question of the political will to do it.
Well, about, if I may say something else about portability, yeah, there are various degrees of portability. One degree is we talk about social insurance, and there, you have been clearly, if you are a contributor, then you get right to get some transfer in case something happens. It's not only pension, but clearly also for unemployment insurance or other health insurance. However, many countries do have minimum vesting periods. So if you don't satisfy these minimum contribution periods, then you leave the country before reaching this limit, then you don't get right to anything, to any transfer. This has been a very powerful way by which countries have been free riding, doing social free riding on migrants. My view of portability is that you do accumulate rights across borders, and therefore the length of your contribution period is calculated based on your full history of contributions. And then each country contributes to the payment, suppose that you become unemployed, based on the on your contribution record and on the national rules. So if you have been spending, say, 6 months in a country and that has an unemployment benefit that pays 20% of your salary for a month, if you have 6 months, so that country should pay that part even if a person is living abroad. So that would be really the way to have portability. We may also talk about portability in other dimension. In terms of the pensions, clearly, given that we all have a public system, I agree with Nick that if it were to be a funded scheme, then most of the problem won't be there. I mean, just leave a country, bring your money together with you, and clearly there need to be some regulations allowing you to do that, but basically this is relatively easy to achieve. In the case of a pay-as-you-go, it's more complicated. But again, if you apply the type of principle I was proposing, that should work. And about the skill downgrading, I fully agree with you. That's a very important dimension of migration. There are a lot of people coming here and being over-educated for the job they do, and that creates another surplus for the country hosting them.
I'd just like to come back briefly to preservation. A long time ago, I was a graduate student in America. I had 4 years of Social Security contributions. In the US, you need 10 years of contributions before you get any pension, unless you have a contributions record in a country with whom the US has a double taxation agreement like the UK. So because I have a full contributions record here, my 4 years in the US count, and I now get a US Social Security pension of $23 a month. That's an example of what's perfectly practical, again, if the political will is there.
So you gain from the devaluation of the pound.
Yep.
Hugely. Before we move to the next question, can I sneak in one question to what Nick said earlier about the European-wide instrument, savings instrument? I mean, I understand the kind of economies of scale and side of the argument in favour of that, but there's also a question of whether if you put too many eggs in one basket, then you don't diversify risk, and if something goes wrong, then everything goes bad for everybody. So, do we know something about how do we deal with that threat?
Yes. The United States has got something called the Thrift Savings Plan for federal civil servants. And if you're a civil servant, you make your contribution, and the people who manage the plan outsource the savings of members to private pension companies in tranches, as sort of on a wholesale basis. So I don't choose a pension provider. The managers choose that, and by taking the savings of members and giving 50 million to one institution and 50 million to another, they've got 20 or 30 different institutions investing. If there were to be a European one, that would be a useful model. And clearly, you would need to get a cross-country spread either within portfolios or across. And what members of the Thrift Savings Plan get is the average return across all the providers who are managing the pensions assets. I mean, you're quite right. It would have to be diversified. That would be a cost-effective way of doing so.
Okay. I think a question here.
Richard Bronk, European Institute. I wanted to ask a sort of left-field theoretical question here. You've all three of you made a very good case for continued labour mobility within Europe and between Europe and the UK. And Smith and Ricardo, who Nick mentioned, of course, made pretty cast-iron economic arguments for comparative advantage for free trade. What I wanted to ask, though, is that the free trade argument from Smith and Ricardo always assumed, it was just their assumption, that the capital stayed at home and was invested in the countries, in the industries which had the comparative advantage. And looking at the destabilization in the world economy in the last 10 years, and the populists are blaming it on free trade and on migration, mobility, is the real culprit capital mobility, which is, take for example, capital mobility coming out of the money having flowed into southern Europe, flowing out again very, very rapidly as the crisis imploded, and the hollowing out of industry in northern Europe by the capital being invested by northern European firms in China and other places rather than at home? Is capital mobility the problem rather than labour mobility and trade mobility?
Very big question.
Yes. As you know, economics is about optimization. So the fact that something is good doesn't mean that more of it is necessarily better. Competition is good, but we regulate it for good reason. Factor mobility generally is good, but it should be optimized, not maximized. And there are good arguments for why one might want capital mobility to be less than fully free. Capital mobility has got different motives. If it's just finance chasing high interest rates, that's destabilizing, and things like a Tobin tax on international financial transactions are intended as sort of grit to reduce the extent of that. But there are good reasons for international capital mobility. I talked about demographics, declining number of workers, response to which is, one response is to invest in human physical capital. Another way is to import workers, but you can import workers in two ways. You can do it directly by allowing more liberal immigration, or you can import labour indirectly by exporting capital to countries with young populations. And it seems to me that demography gives a sound reason for mobility, for some mobility of capital, quite separate from the general mobility argument. So I would say you're absolutely right. Capital mobility needs to be looked at and taken seriously. But it shouldn't be, it shouldn't be maximized, but it shouldn't be minimized either, and it certainly shouldn't be blamed for the fact that the losers from globalization have been inadequately compensated, which is a separate problem with a separate solution.
Well, yes, no. There is clearly a capital mobility dimension, which is very important. You know, funded schemes, as we were talking about, may also be in a better position to do the type of diversification that Nick was talking about, and basically go also to these younger countries, invest in these younger countries, and therefore also reduce the pressure for migration from these countries. Another consideration that I'd like to make is that if you look at the diagram that Vasilis was showing before about migration, the effect of migration on the labor market, there the key assumption is that migrants do not come with any capital with them, including their own capital, which is basically the human capital. If we do consider that migration often involves also human capital dimension, you know, the skill dimension, which is very important, then the impact of migration may be more favorable for the recipient country, because if they come also with some human capital, there will be also a change in the labor demand, not only a shift of the labor supply. And that is something to consider.
I would also like to add my favorite topic on industrial policy. And I think Nick was absolutely right that it makes a difference whether we're talking about high frequency portfolio movements here or foreign direct investment. But even within actual, you know, foreign direct investment, you do have different types, more speculative and more mobile versus something that tries to exploit the local comparative advantages and builds on them. And I think what we did have simultaneously was not only capital account liberalization and high speed capital mobility, but also the disappearance of industrial policy proper, delegitimization of government intervention in that field. And at least in some places, this led to very speculative investments in wrong places, even if they were long-term, so not only portfolio investments. So maybe, again, an issue of optimization, but you need a balance, allow capital to move, but also direct it in the right places in some way. Okay, we can take another one or two questions. So.
Thank you. Angelo Martelli, PhD candidate, also at the European Institute. So Farage says that he's actually spent 10 years trying to make immigration synonymous with EU membership. And actually, there is a recent study by the Oxford University on the British election study, which actually says that this is pretty much true what has happened in the EU referendum. So Farage, in a way, has succeeded. And if you also think of the works by Lakoff on the framing of the issue, in a way, I think populists are actually succeeding because they, in a way, know their values and they've been able to frame the issue in the right way. So do you think there are any lessons that can be learned? I mean, you have, all three of you have been trying to put forward the case why it is important to have immigration, why it is important to have why portability matters and so on. Is there anything that can be changed in the way we also portray the case that you've just made? And also, I think one discussion that is being going on right now in the US, it's the globalization, so closing the borders, actually not, I mean, being quite myopic, because actually there will be the immigrants from the future that will then, the immigrants from the future being robots, that will then replace actually workers like within the US economy. I mean, how do you see these playing out in Europe, and how do you see then, why isn't there any success for these EU-wide initiatives, such as the low success of the youth guarantee, such as the low success of any unemployment issue? Why is there such a low success in that? Thank you.
Would like to.
I mean, just let me start with an economic point, which is, I mean, we've been looking at what theory and evidence says, but then we're experts and we're the liberal elite and we're all those things that didn't play very well in the referendum. I think there is one policy lesson, which is, reform is much easier when there's economic growth and much harder when there isn't. And if you've had an economic crisis and austerity, then times are tough, living standards aren't rising, people are feeling pretty grumpy about life. And if you're feeling grumpy, you hang your grumpiness on the nearest coat hook, and immigrants are a convenient scapegoat, which is why I said what needed to happen was there are some genuine grievances underlying it, particularly underinvestment in skills, not at the university level, but at the level below that. And that, in a way, part of the political, that there is both an economic and a political argument for addressing these people's rightful grievances as a way of easing the politics of further immigration. But I think you can see how it happened. But part of the reason why it happened was people have had a hard time, and you need to try and make it somewhat less hard.